Welcome to today's program titled 2014 National Year in Review, What You Need to Know About the Recent Cases, Development in Trade Secrets, Non-Compete, and Computer Fraud. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen. Then type and send your question that way. This presentation has been prepared by Seyfarth Shaw, LLP, for informational purposes only and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or a legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general information purposes only, and you are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachments, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purpose of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation, which will be required on the CLE attendance affirmation form sent with the login information email. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. There will be an archived version of the presentation available. A follow-up email with ordering instructions will be sent out later this week. At this time, I'd like to turn it over to Robert Milligan. Robert?
Thank you so much, and thank you to the audience for joining us for today's webinar. I'd like to introduce you briefly to our panel. We're joined by Michael Wexler. Michael's the head of the litigation department in Chicago, and he's also the chair of the Trade Secrets, Non-Compete, and Computer Fraud Group. We're also joined by Daniel Hart, who is a partner in our Atlanta office. Dan specializes, like Michael, on trade secret and non-compete cases throughout the country, as well as providing counseling and international trade secret advice. My name is Robert Milligan. I'm the co-chair of our Trade Secrets Non-Compete and Computer Fraud Group. I'm based out of Los Angeles, and I'm a partner with Seyfarth Shaw. We have a very ambitious agenda today, so we'd like to get right into it. Now, feel free to ask any questions. Your drop-down menu should provide you the ability to ask questions, and we plan to field those questions at the end of the presentation. So please do let yourself use that feature. Today, we're going to cover what we regard as the top 10 developments in trade secrets, non-compete, and computer fraud law over the past year. I will handle topics 1 through 3, Daniel Hart will cover topics 4 through 7, and Mike Wexler will cover topics 8 through 10, as well as provide some practical tips. Just to give you a brief overview of the topics that we will cover, the first development has been the increased threat to trade secrets by hackers. Next, there's been a number of noteworthy criminal prosecutions and criminal sentences for criminal trade secret misappropriation. There's been several cases and convictions this year that we want to highlight for you. Another thing that's been in the news recently has been the proposed federal statute on trade secret theft. We're going to give you an update on where that particular legislation is at. Dan's going to discuss a similar effort that's happening in the EU to harmonize trade secret law and create a baseline for trade secret protection in the EU. He's also going to discuss the recent developments in Massachusetts, where they tried to pass a similar statute, similar to California, in outlawing non-competes, as well as their efforts to try to adopt the Uniform Trade Secret Act in Massachusetts. He's also going to discuss some social media developments that impact the protection of trade secrets. And he's going to discuss also some very controversial National Labor Relations Board rulings on the use of social media policies and IT resources policies and the implications of using those policies to protect trade secrets. Michael's going to talk about the Uniform Trade Secret Act preemption and some of the recent cases, particularly in Arizona, dealing with preemption. One very hot topic this year has been the use of choice of law provisions and forum selection clauses. The recent Supreme Court decision in Atlantic Marine has had more and more companies using mandatory forum selection provisions to focus non-compete litigation in their particular home forum where non-competes may be enforceable. And then finally, we're going to do an overview of some very popular decisions that have come out that really address the issue of consideration and what consideration is necessary in order for there to be a binding non-compete agreement. In some jurisdictions, continued employment is sufficient consideration, whereas in some jurisdictions, such as Illinois, you may need something more than continued employment to have a binding non-compete agreement. With that, we'll get into the first development. Obviously, there's been lots of literature this year about the data security breaches and the threats posed by hackers to trade secrets. As demonstrated by a recent high-profile cyber attack, hackers represent a significant and growing threat to the intellectual property of the United States and multinational companies. Last year, Create.org released a white paper that highlighted how far-reaching and deeply challenging trade secret theft is for companies operating on a global scale, and identified hacktivists, foreign governments, and organized crime, as well as competitor and rogue employees, as the major threats to trade secrets. Notably, the Create.org white paper found that trade secret theft costs anywhere between 1 to 3% of the GDP of the United States and other industrial economies. A recent quote in Inside Counsel highlights the threat posed by hackers and data security breaches. This was in the recent Inside Counsel magazine, and the former Deputy General Counsel of IT Corporation, Wendy Hufford, said, "Major data breach can result in decreased consumer confidence, class action lawsuits, regulatory investigations, and millions of dollars for expenses for legal fees, fines, settlements, consumer notification, and credit monitoring. With the recent termination of senior executives following this type of data breach incident, the entire C-suite, including the general counsel, is taking notice of this high-risk area and creating action plans to address these issues." A recent study by the Mandiant Group found that for many U.S. corporations, they're not even aware that hackers are on their networks. In fact, the average number of days that a hacker was present on a network before being detected was 243 days. And those companies did not find out about the hacker being present on their own. They actually found out about it from outside third parties, typically law enforcement. 63% of the companies that were part of the study indicated that they actually had learned that they were a victim of a targeted attack from an external party, namely law enforcement. The National Intelligence Group recently stated that the United States is the target of a massive, sustained cyber espionage campaign that is threatening the country's competitiveness. And so what are these threats to trade secrets and these threats caused by data security breaches? The main groups are hackers, criminal gangs, rogue employees, political hacktivists, and foreign states. Much, but certainly not all of the attention on foreign threats to trade secrets has been focused on the People's Republic of China. Last year, Mandiant published a report finding that the government of the People's Republic of China is sponsoring cyber espionage to attack top U.S. companies. It should be noted that a few recent decisions from the courts in Shanghai suggest that some courts in the PRC may be adopting an enforcement approach in trade secrets and non-compete cases that is closer to the approach of U.S. courts. Notwithstanding this potentially significant development in the PRC, hackers, especially those tied to foreign governments in China and North Korea, will likely continue to pose a major threat to U.S. and multinational companies in the near future. At the end of today's presentation, we'll discuss some practical tips in light of all these developments that we're talking about today. But before we move on to the next topic, we should briefly note some of the practical measures to avoid data theft by hackers. Often companies think that mitigating the risk of data theft is primarily a matter of implementing IT measures, such as building firewalls, encrypting documents, and requiring passwords. These technical measures are essential, but there's much more to mitigating the risk of data theft. employee training is absolutely essential. You need to have appropriate corporate policies in place. We'll discuss some of those policies later on, and you need to train employees on these policies. Employees should also be trained on spotting and avoiding scams that hackers frequently use, such as requests for passwords and using deceptive hyperlinks. For example, something that appears like a legitimate email from ADP or FedEx or UPS, but that has a link to a website that's not affiliated with the company that is represented in the email. The goal of this training is to create a culture of compliance where employees understand the importance of protecting data. Vendor selection is also critical. Your workforce can be top-notch on avoiding risk of data theft, but if your vendors don't have appropriate measures in place, you're also at risk. It's also very important to make sure that you have insurance and appropriate cyber protection insurance. Based upon your particular company's place in the marketplace, a policy that will cover a data breach. The numbers run the gamut, but a typical data breach was estimated at costing companies up to $5 million. So it's obviously important to make sure that you have sufficient insurance in place in case your systems are breached. And it's not a matter of if, it's more a matter of when, and making sure that you have a proactive plan in place to address what happens when you're notified that there's been a breach. It's important to have a multi-department team for a particular company that actually owns cybersecurity. Often within companies, there's a debate about who owns the cybersecurity role, whether it's IT, whether it's legal, whether it's some other group within a company. But it's important to have a multi-department team that constantly evaluates what the risks are to the company, has a contingency plan in place, and tests its plan regularly. IT measures can only go so far. Having the latest and greatest as far as a security software is important, but without effective leadership and without effective employee training in place, all hope, you know, it's not going to be enough to solve the issue and put in appropriate measures. And it's also worth noting that you need to have a special policy for cyber insurance. It's not going to be enough just to have general commercial liability policy in place, but a policy that specifically covers data breach. Our next noteworthy development was some noteworthy criminal prosecutions and criminal sentences, namely the U.S. versus Liu case in the Northern District of California, as well as the U.S. versus Dong case in the Western District of Pennsylvania. Now, it's been reported that the U.S. versus Liu case was the first ever jury conviction under the Economic Espionage Act. Now, the Economic Espionage Act criminalizes the theft of trade secrets at the federal level. In this particular case, a jury convicted Walter Liu and his company, U.S. Performance Technology, for conspiring to steal trade secrets from DuPont and selling them to an overseas company controlled by the government of the PRC. As far as his conviction went, he was convicted and he was sentenced to 15 years in prison. Now, this recent prosecution and conviction works in dovetail with the Obama administration's recent report that unveiled a government-wide strategy designed to reduce trade secret theft by hackers and employees and companies. Consistent with this strategy, in 2014, the Department of Justice continued to push high-profile prosecutions under both the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and the Economic Espionage Act, particularly against defendants tied to the Chinese government. In the other high-profile case that was mentioned, U.S. versus Dong, a federal grand jury indicted five high-ranking officials of the PRC, People's Liberation Army, for computer hacking, economic espionage, and other offenses directed at American companies in the nuclear power, metals, and solar products industries. We expect there to be more high-profile prosecutions in this year as the federal government continues to further crack down on trade secret theft. Our third significant development this year was the proposed federal statute on trade secrets theft. Now, this was back in 2014. Primarily in the spring of 2014 when it was first introduced in the Senate by Senator Coons and Senator Hatch. Now, in the past several years, we've seen increased attempts to create a civil cause of action for trade secret misappropriation at the federal level, and 2014 was no exception. As mentioned, Senator Coons and Senator Hatch introduced the Defend Trade Secrets Act of 2014 in the Senate. The bill would have amended the Economic Espionage Act to create a civil cause of action for private litigants for violations of 18 U.S.C. 1831 and 1832. And the specific language that it uses is the misappropriation of a trade secret that is related to a product or service used or intended for use in interstate or foreign commerce. Essentially, what it would provide for companies was the ability to have access to the federal courts to pursue trade secret claims against those who misappropriated their trade secrets, whether those include foreign actors, former employees, or former business partners. The federal courts would be open to companies for suing for trade secret theft, and you would not need to have diversity jurisdiction, but you would have federal jurisdiction for such a claim. The bill was intended to harmonize U.S. law by providing for rules and remedies that would apply across all 50 states and in all U.S. territories. The bill includes definitions of misappropriation and improper that generally track the definition of those terms in the Uniform Trade Secret Act. Interestingly, the bill does not include the definition of the term trade secret because the Economic Espionage Act already has a statutory definition of the term. However, the definition under the Economic Espionage Act is similar, but not identical to the Uniform Trade Secret Act definition. As I mentioned, the bill would create a private cause of action for violations of the Economic Espionage Act. Essentially, there would be a private action for trade secret theft for the benefit of companies throughout the United States to sue if their trade secrets were misappropriated. The bill also expressly includes remedies that go beyond what is currently authorized by law. For example, in addition to injunctive relief, which is already available in federal courts under Rule 65, the bill would authorize courts to issue ex parte orders for preservation of evidence and seizure of misappropriated trade secrets in the same way that courts already have are authorized to do in trademark cases. This provision has generated a fair amount of controversy and some have questioned whether this remedy may be subject to abuse and have concerns about its implementation. Not to be outdone by the Senate, there has been some congressmen in the House who also proposed trade secret legislation last year, the Trade Secret Protection Act of 2014. It's a bill that was introduced, and it was very similar to the Senate bill, but has tighter language on the ex parte seizure order, and hope to tighten the language so to make it more palatable to those who have objected to the ex parte seizure language in the Senate bill. This particular bill largely tracks the Senate's Defend Trade Secret Act, but it really clarifies that the ex parte seizure order is not something that should be abused and has certain precautions to avoid against abuse, so that if someone seeks an ex parte seizure order and it's shown that it was without merit, that you can have the recovery of fees for them for trying to pursue that remedy. Before the House adjourned last year, the House Judiciary Committee reported favorably on the bill and recommended its passage. Although the House did not pass the bill before adjourning, expect to see the same or similar legislation introduced earlier this year, Specifically, the USPTO, the Patent Office, recently had a trade secret symposium, and some of the key leaders that are pushing for a federal trade secret bill attended the symposium and presented, and they indicated that they expect that the bills, both in the Senate and the House, will be proposed sometime later this year, and they expect to receive bipartisan support. And that's what's something that's significant about both of these proposed bills is that they did receive bipartisan support. So this may be an area where Congress could agree to create this federal civil cause of action. Across the pond, there's a similar movement afoot to create uniformity and cohesion as it relates to trade secrets. With that, I'll turn it over to Dan Hart to discuss the movement in the EU to create a similar type of uniform trade secret system.
Well, thank you very much, Robert. And as you can see from the slides, our fourth big topic is this proposed EU trade secrets directive. Trade secrets regulation in Europe is somewhat similar to the situation here in the U.S., but the lack of uniformity in Europe is even more pronounced than what we have here. Currently, there's no EU-wide regulation of trade secrets, and many of the member states don't have any specific statutory provisions that protect trade secrets. A handful of member states have statutes on misappropriation, and the member states that have a common law system, such as the UK and the Republic of Ireland, regulate trade secrets misappropriation by common law causes of action. But substantial differences exist from state to state in the EU, and the remedies for trade secrets theft are generally quite limited. And so in light of this situation, the European Commission issued the proposed directive at the end of 2013. If it's enacted by the European Parliament, the directive will require all 28 member states to enact national legislation that meets certain uniform standards and provides uniform remedies, including injunctive and declaratory relief, damages, and sanctions for noncompliance. At this point, the European Council of Ministers, which is a body composed of the heads of state of the 28 member states that make up the EU, has approved of the proposed directive, but with some amendments. Now the directive is being considered by three separate committees of the European Parliament, and all those committees will have to weigh in on the proposal. Right now, there's not a timeline for a vote in the European Parliament, but it is expected that the proposal will be scheduled for a first reading sometime this year after the committees have weighed in and after the Council and the Parliament have gone through the inevitable process of negotiating any disagreements that they have about the proposal. Before moving on to the next topic, I think we should go into some detail on what the proposal, the proposed directive would do. And at this stage in the legislative process, it's important to keep in mind that the directive remains merely a proposal. However, several aspects of the directive, if adopted, would substantially alter the existing legal landscape, and would create a more harmonized trade secret regime throughout the EU. And three features of the directive are particularly noteworthy. And the first feature that's really noteworthy is that the directive provides a common definition of the term trade secrets, and it also provides uniform rules about the acquisition, use, and disclosure of trade secrets. For example, in language that is in a lot of ways similar to the definition of trade secrets under the UTSA here in the United States, the proposed directive defines a trade secret as, quote, information which meets all the following requirements. It is secret in the sense that it is not, as a body or in the precise configuration and assembly of its components, generally known among or readily accessible to persons within the circles that normally deal with the kind of information in question. And it has commercial value because it's a secret, and that it has been subject to reasonable steps under the circumstances by the person lawfully in control of the information to keep it secret. And so that would be a uniform definition of trade secrets if the directive is adopted. The proposed directive also provides that acquisition of a trade secret is unlawful, quote, whenever carried out intentionally or with gross negligence by, and then it lists a number of different actions. The first is unauthorized access to or copy of any documents, objects, materials, substances, or electronic files lawfully under the control of the trade secret holder containing the trade secret or from which the trade secret can be deduced. That's the first action. It could also be unlawful if it's theft, bribery, deception, breach or inducement to breach a confidentiality agreement or any other duty to maintain secrecy, or finally, any other conduct which, under the circumstances, is considered contrary to honest commercial practices. So these definitions in the directive really provide a fair amount of guidance as to what's going to be considered unlawful if the directive is adopted. Secondly, notably, the directive establishes a common set of procedures and remedies for trade secret holders where there is unlawful acquisition, use, or disclosure of that trade secret. Among other provisions, the directive has a 2-year statute of limitations for bringing claims for trade secrets misappropriation. I should note that when the Council of Ministers set out their proposal, they thought that the statute of limitations should be longer. So it's possible that ultimately, when and if this is adopted, there will be a longer statute of limitations set out in the directive. Also notably, the directive includes rules on the preservation of trade secrets during litigation, which is very important. Some of the member states in the EU really don't have discovery and other rules that would currently guarantee the protection of trade secrets in litigation. And the third most important development is that the directive provides for uniform remedies for civil law redress for trade secrets misappropriation, and that would be across all the 28 member states. Among other things, the directive calls for injunctive and declaratory relief, damages, and sanctions for noncompliance. It also includes a variety of reporting provisions. Now, if the directive does come into place, member states will need to implement their own statute or law that's consistent with the directive within 2 years from the date of adoption of the directive. The EU directives lay down certain end results that must be achieved in every member state by a specific date. And so essentially, individual member states can and should adapt their law to meet these goals. But they're free to decide how to do so. So ultimately, if this is passed by the European Parliament, we'll then have to look at what each of the member states do in terms of implementing it in their own national law. Well, before closing out legislative topics, we should briefly note last year's developments in Massachusetts, and that is our fifth big topic to talk about today. In what has become an annual tradition over the past several years, lawmakers in Massachusetts once again debated but failed to pass legislation that would have overhauled the state's existing law on non-competes and trade secrets, which are currently in Massachusetts governed by common law. Along with New York, Massachusetts is one of only two states that has not yet adopted some version of the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. And this past legislative session, the Massachusetts legislature considered a fairly controversial bill that would have adopted the UTSA. That wasn't particularly controversial, but more controversially, would have eliminated or virtually eliminated all employee non-compete agreements in Massachusetts. And so, as Robert mentioned earlier, essentially it would make Massachusetts like California. Well, that bill ultimately did not pass, but the state Senate overwhelmingly approved a compromise bill. That compromise bill would not have eliminated non-competes in Massachusetts, but it would have placed a lot more restrictions on use of employee non-competes. Specifically, it would have required that non-competes be in writing and signed by both the employee and the employer, and expressly state that the employee has the right to consult with counsel prior to signing the agreement. It also would have provided that, to the extent reasonably feasible, employees must be given 5 business days advance notice before being required to sign a non-compete agreement. And it also provided that, if entered into after commencement of employment, but not in connection with the separation agreement, the non-compete agreement has to be supported by fair and reasonable consideration in addition to continued employment. So it's not enough under this bill anyway simply to provide continued employment as consideration for a non-compete. The compromise bill also provided that notice by the employer has to be provided at least 10 business days before the agreement is to be effective. Again, that's all not in connection with a separation agreement. Now, in connection with a separation agreement, the bill provided that the employee had to be given 7 days to rescind acceptance of the agreement. So if you're familiar with the provisions under the Older Workers Benefit Protection Act, which allows a period of 7 days to revoke acceptance of an agreement waiving ADEA claims, there would be a similar provision in Massachusetts with respect to non-competes. Despite the approval of this compromise bill by the state Senate, ultimately the legislature did not pass the compromise bill or any of the other alternative bills that were being debated last year. But if recent history is any guide, we expect to see attempts to overhaul Massachusetts non-compete and trade secrets law again this year. And indeed, before last year's legislative session ended, outgoing Governor Deval Patrick, who is now left office, nonetheless introduced another compromise bill that we expect legislatures will debate this year. And like the previous compromise bill, this newly introduced bill would place some limits on non-competes without flat out abolishing them in the Bay State. As with the earlier bill, it would require that the non-competes be in writing and signed by both the employee and the employer. It would again require 5 days business days advance notice, and it would have the same requirements about being supported by fair and reasonable consideration in addition to continued employment. The compromise bill that Governor Patrick proposed that we think is going to be debated this year would also create presumptions of reasonableness. It would provide that a non-compete of 6 months or less is presumed reasonable as to duration. It would provide that the area in which the employee worked during the last 2 years of employment would be presumed to be reasonable. And it would also provide that certain activities would deem to be reasonable if it was limited to specific types of services provided by the employee during the last 2 years of employment. Interestingly, it also bans the use of non-competes altogether for certain workers classified as non-exempt under the Fair Labor Standards Act. So essentially, hourly workers could not be parties to non-competes. And finally, the bill would allow courts to reform non-competes only where the provision to be altered is either presumptively reasonable or where the employer made, quote, objectively reasonable efforts to draft a particular provision so that it would be presumptively reasonable. So as I mentioned before, this is just a proposed bill. The legislative session has just begun. Certainly, there's a lot more going on today in Massachusetts than debating non-compete and trade secrets bills. But we are going to continue to monitor progress on this bill as it's debated by the legislature, and we will be reporting on any developments on our blog, www.tradesecretslaw.com. Well, this takes us to the sixth major development from 2014, which is related to social media. Continuing a trend over the past several years, social media continues to generate disputes in trade secret, computer fraud, and non-compete law, as well as in privacy law. As you can note from the screen, several states, Wisconsin, Louisiana, Oklahoma, New Hampshire, and Rhode Island, joined a number of other states last year in enacting legislation to protect personal use of social media by employees. In general, these laws prohibit employers from requiring or even from requesting that employees provide access to their private social media accounts. And that could be either through requiring the employee to disclose username and passwords, or having an employee open the account in the presence of his or her boss, having the boss look over the shoulder. Or it could be requiring the employee to add an employer representative to the employee's contact list. And when you get this friend request from the director of HR, you have to accept that, or from requiring the employee to alter his or her privacy settings on the account so that the employee can access the information on the private account. Almost 20 states now have laws that place these kinds of limits on employers' access of employees' private social media accounts. And we expect that other states are going to get on the social media bandwagon this next year and then in the years ahead. If I can pause here for an advertisement, I should note that we have a desktop reference available on request that provides an overview of the social media privacy law in each state that has adopted one. Last year's desktop reference is already available, and we will be updating it in the next few months to account for new state laws that have been passed recently. Now, it's important to note what these statutes do not do. These statutes don't mean that employees are free to steal their employer's data and share it with the whole world by posting it on Facebook or LinkedIn or some other social media account. The laws are in most of these states have lots of exceptions. For example, many of the laws allow employers to access accounts during the course of investigations of employee misconduct or theft of employer data. And so if there is some misuse of social media accounts to steal employers' confidential information, employers still can investigate that. But what these laws do mean is that employers should look at their existing policies on social media use and ensure that the policies are consistent with the laws in all the states where they have employees. Now, when it comes to protecting trade secrets, these laws also mean that employers should give some thought to how they protect the content of social media accounts that employees use for work-related purposes. I mentioned that the social media privacy statutes generally apply to employees' personal social media accounts, but it's not always clear if a social media account is owned by the employer or owned by the employee. This question has been a continuing source of disputes, and courts are increasingly having to decide whether content in LinkedIn or in other social media accounts can be a trade secret. A few months ago, a federal district court in California issued a very well-publicized decision in the Cellular Accessories case. You can see the entire site for it on the screen. And in that case, it was undisputed that after he left his employment, an employee emailed himself his employer's customer lists, and that he also continued to maintain his LinkedIn account that included information of contacts that he had developed while he was employed by the employer. The employer filed a lawsuit and asserted several claims against the employee, including a claim for misappropriation of trade secrets. Not surprisingly, the employee moved for summary judgment, and he argued that there was no misappropriation of trade secrets because neither the customer list nor the LinkedIn contact info were trade secrets in his view. Interestingly, the court denied the motion for summary judgment. With respect to the customer list, the court noted that a customer list can be a trade secret if the methods used to compile the information in the list are sophisticated, difficult, or particularly time-consuming, and the court determined that this was a disputed issue of fact in the case. Likewise, and this is really where the opinion is significant, the court determined that there was a disputed issue of fact as to whether the contact info in the LinkedIn account was a trade secret. The court didn't say that the contact info absolutely was a trade secret, only that it could be, and that it was a disputed issue of fact. And shortly after the court reached this decision, the case settled, and so the court never reached a definitive conclusion as to whether, under these facts, the LinkedIn contact information was a trade secret. But the case does illustrate that LinkedIn and other social media contexts in some circumstances can be protectable as trade secrets. We'll have to see how the courts develop this line of thinking in the future, but presumably the employer will have to show that the methods used to compile the contact information in the account are sophisticated, difficult, or particularly time-consuming, akin to a customer list. And also, the employer is going to have to establish that the contacts were not made public in order for the contact information to be entitled to trade secret protection. As use of social media continues to proliferate, we expect that more courts are going to weigh in on this issue. In the meantime, employers should consider spelling out the ownership of content in social media accounts if they're requiring employees to use social media accounts to further the company's business. And Michael will talk later today in the presentation about some of these practical tips. Before I hand it over to Michael, I want to touch briefly on our seventh big topic from 2014. And this really continues on with the theme of social media, because last year the National Labor Relations Board issued two particularly significant decisions that have left a lot of employers scrambling to revise their existing policies on employee use of social media and on use of IT resources. The first decision that's noteworthy is the Triple Play decision. You can see the citation information about it on the screen. And the background to this decision, as well as the other one we'll talk about, is Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act, which protects employees' rights to engage in concerted activities regarding the terms and conditions of their employment. In the Triple Play decision, the NLRB ruled that employees engaged in concerted activities that were protected by Section 7 when one employee commented on Facebook that the employer had made errors in calculating the employee's tax withholdings, so that was protected activity, and another employee, in the board's mind, engaged in protected activity simply by clicking like on his Facebook settings, saying that he liked the comment. The board notably also held that the employer's internet and blogging policy violated Section 7. The policy at issue provided that, quote, engaging in inappropriate discussions about the company, management, and or coworkers may be violating the law, and the employee who does that is subject to disciplinary action up to and including termination of employment. That policy may not seem like it's particularly unusual or out of the ordinary, but the board held that that policy, as written, was overly broad and violated the NLRA because, read literally, it would prevent employees from exercising their Section 7 rights. The second decision that's notable is the Purple Communications decision, which came out towards the end of last year. And in that decision, the NLRB ruled that employees who have access to an employer's email system as part of their job generally may, during non-working time, use the email system to communicate about wages, hours, working conditions, and union issues. The NLRB did recognize some exceptions to the rule, but they created a fairly sweeping presumption that has been extremely controversial. And the specific language of their presumption is, quote, we will presume that employees who have rightful access to their employer's email system in the course of their work have a right to use the email system to engage in Section 7 protected communications on non-working time. An employer may rebut the presumption by demonstrating that special circumstances necessary to maintain production or discipline justify restricting its employees' rights. Because limitations on employee communication should be no more restrictive than necessary to protect the employer's interests, we anticipate that it will be the rare case where special circumstances justify a total ban on non-work email used by employees, end quote. So that's obviously a very sweeping presumption the NLRB has adopted. As with social media law, it's important to note that what these rulings don't do. They don't mean that employers are free to steal their employers' confidential data and post it on Facebook or comment about it on the web. But what these decisions do mean is that employers need to look at their existing social media and IT policies to ensure that they have appropriate caveats in their language, and that as written, the policies are not so broad that they would be limitations on employees' ability to exercise their Section 7 rights. And I should mention that the same thing applies to non-disclosure agreements. If the NDA prevents employees from engaging in activities protected by Section 7, employers might face an unfair labor practices charge, even, this is important, if their workforce is not unionized. And so for this reason, it's prudent to take another look at template agreements that the company uses to see if any revisions are in order in light of these decisions. And with that, I'll hand it over to Michael to discuss some other big developments.
Thanks. We're going to run through a few things here. We want to make sure you get the full benefits of the materials that we want to cover today. So we're going to move a little quickly here. But first, I want to give you the CLE credit information. To receive one credit of CLE for this webinar, please write down the following code on the CLE attendance affirmation form, which will be emailed to you at the end of this week. The code is SS4556. Looking at the next topic here, continued confusion about the Uniform Trade Secrets Act preemptive impact. It's been in the news. You've probably read a case or two, or you've heard about this issue. There is a growing body of case law and growing level of concern that the Uniform Trade Secret Act is preempting common law claims for breach of confidentiality. And we see this a lot in California. California actually has a common law claim for breach of confidentiality. And as you probably note on the slide here, the Uniform Trade Secrets Act in most states, and there are about 48 that have adopted some form of this, basically the misappropriation statute preempts common law claims, tort claims, restitution claims, and other civil remedies. And the act also specifically does not preempt contractual remedies, such as breach of contract, and also does not preempt civil remedies or criminal remedies that are provided for pursuant to statutes. But there's been a growing body of case law on this. Recently, the Orca Communications case came down in Arizona, and the Arizona Supreme Court sided with the latter group, which is a group that finds that common law claims for breach of confidentiality are not displaced by the misappropriation statute or the Uniform Trade Secret Act. So you know, that's one decision on one side of the issue. California has a number of decisions on the other side of the issue, but it is an issue you should be concerned about when it comes to looking at how do you protect your confidential information and how do you enforce your agreements that you may have and what do you do when someone takes information. We also should mention here, just because we're talking about protection of information, that the enclosures block case, which came down from the Seventh Circuit recently, that case analyzes what protections are necessary. And I think the takeaway from that particular case is that simply having a confidentiality agreement to protect your information is not enough. You need to take other steps, such as, and they comment on the case in this, which is that you should be marking things confidential, you should be locking things up, you should be limiting access, and doing those sorts of things. So just something to be aware of in light of that case, that simply signing an agreement is not enough. You need to take additional steps, training steps, having seminars or memos reminding people about confidentiality and having a culture of confidentiality in light of that case. The next topic is the issue about forum selection clauses. And this is an extremely important topic because it's something that can literally change the entire approach that any organization takes with their agreements. Typically, you may have agreements that are different for California, different for Louisiana, different for North Dakota, different for Wisconsin, different for Oregon, New Hampshire, other states where there are specific requirements under those state statutes. But what's happened is in December 2013, U.S. Supreme Court came down with a case called Atlantic Marine. And in the Atlantic Marine decision, it was a construction dispute. But in that case, when they discussed the construction contract, there was a choice of law and a venue provision. And that contract One of the issues was, well, will those be upheld? And the long and short of Atlantic Marine is that absent exceptional circumstances, choices of law and choices of venue will be upheld. And so what's happened is if you look at California, for example, there are five cases, four pre-Atlantic Marine, one after Atlantic Marine, on this issue with regard to choice of law and venue. And those cases, all in the federal courts, have upheld choice of law and venue provisions that take agreements outside of California. And that's a somewhat different approach than the California courts have generally taken in the past, because California law is very different on this topic of non-competes and trade secret protection. So it's something to be aware of, that you may be able to use an agreement that allows you to have a choice of law and venue, let's say in your forum state where you have your headquarters, or maybe your major operations, and you choose, you know, we'll just pick any old state. We'll pick Illinois, for example. It could be Iowa, it could be Utah, it could be anywhere, but you pick that state because that's where you're based, and you use the venue and choice of law provision for that state because that's where you're based. There is U.S. Supreme Court support, and then in California, for example, support that choice of law and that venue provision will be upheld. And when you have states like a California, Louisiana, North Dakota, other places where the law is different, you may be able to essentially sidestep the law in those states because of the decision in Atlantic Marine. And what you have on the screen here are some cases, the Amco case, Hagwer case, and Hartstein case, wherein forum selection clauses have been upheld. In the Amco case, there is a closely related party issue about whether an agreement could be enforced against someone's wife. In the Hagwer case, a motion to dismiss a California action based upon the Pennsylvania forum selection clause that we've just discussed, that was upheld. And then the Hartstein case, a similar issue in which the forum selection was enforced. And so that's something very important that you should be aware of and take into consideration. There have been a few important decisions that have come down during the past year with regard to the restrictive covenant issues, the ExxonMobil case, where essentially, and in Texas, it's important because in Texas, the law used to be the only thing that could be used as consideration for a non-compete was the giving of or access to confidential information. And that's the only thing that's recognized as consideration. The ExxonMobil case actually calls that into question because it held that the enforcement of a forfeiture provision for competitive activity in an incentive plan was not contrary to Texas public policy, which typically that would have been the case previously, where forfeiture provision was a non-compete and that would not be necessarily upheld. Alabama had a decision in the Dawson case in which an agreement executed even a day prior to a person joining the organization was not enforceable. So in Alabama, it's important for people to sign agreements the day they join the organization. In the Knott case, that decision held that a non-compete was unenforceable against an employee who signed a non-compete and they received the benefits for poor lease consideration. But because other employees had not signed, the court held that was unenforceable against a person who did sign because they received the same benefits. So it's always important to treat employees the same. If someone doesn't sign, you have to call into question whether that person can stay with the organization or have access to information that others who did sign. And then finally, in the Charles Creech case, in that case, an existing employee signed the agreement and it wasn't supported by consideration. So it's important that you have consideration when an existing employee signs an agreement. There's a couple other decisions in the recent past that have also said that same thing. Continued employment may not be enough, and you need to actually give consideration to an existing employee when they sign an agreement. And of course, the Fifield decision, it's not up here, we discussed in the past, the Fifield decision in Illinois, which held back in 2013 that you need 2 years of employment, whether it's for a new employee or an existing employee who signs an agreement, to be adequate consideration if the consideration is seemingly employment or continued employment alone. You want to give other consideration in Illinois, such as a bonus, such as equity grants, such as some other form of consideration, not just relying on employment. So then we have some practical tips for you, which you should consider based upon what's been going on in this area. One, review and update templates. The law is changing, choice of law, venue provisions. What jurisdiction do you have employees in, and what law do you want to use, and where do you want to litigate your case? You want to review and revise your onboarding processes. Certain states require that an employee receive agreements at least 14 days prior to joining. These are important considerations in Oregon, New Hampshire, also Washington State, as to who gets agreements and as to when they receive a copy of that agreement and have appropriate time to consider it. Agreements, you need to look at timing when they are signed, i.e. the Alabama decision that came down. You want to make sure you're complying with the state law with regard to execution that you choose to have your agreement interpreted under. You also want to require acknowledgments from employees that they've returned information from their prior employer. And you want to have employees sign and acknowledge social media policies. And you want to make sure, of course, that your social media policies are compliant with the NLRB decisions, which Dan was discussing, because the NLRB has taken a dim views of certain policies that seemingly prohibit concerted action or organizing. You should also review the IT policies that your organization has and see whether those IT policies are helping your organization protect information. Bring your own device policies are important and are recommended in certain situations, but in other situations, company-owned devices are more important so that a company can have access to and review a person's PDA, iPad, those sorts of things in order to make sure that information is properly secured. There's a whole bunch of issues with that depending on whether you use or bring your own device policy or whether you supply devices to your employees. You need to make sure that you're complying with the various laws and restrictions with regard to what you can review and what you cannot review. You want to incorporate, whatever you do, you want to incorporate your policies into your exit review process. And in the exit interview exit interview process, you want to make sure people are acknowledging what agreements they have, acknowledging what they owe to the company, acknowledging that they've returned property, acknowledging exactly all of the items that allow you to protect your organization from someone who might take information or not follow agreements that they've signed. You want to also make sure that in your procedures that you're looking at how exactly do you treat data. And so, for example, you want to make sure that data is encrypted. You want to make sure that sensitive information is limited to employees that have a business need that they need to see and have access to that information, especially in light of that enclosures case that we discussed a moment ago. You want to make sure that things are locked up. If things are in hard copy, they need to be locked up, cleared off of desks at night, in locked file cabinets or locked access areas. You want to make sure documents may be password protected, computers are password protected. You want to also consider whether or not to limit the ability to print or the ability to plug in a device to a laptop or to a desktop. Some organizations literally take caulk and they put it into the USB drive so that folks can't plug in a USB and download information. And then also you want to consider what information people can take with them on a device and can take home from their access from home. Additionally, as we mentioned, the exit interview is very important to certainly reinforce policies and procedures that you have, reinforce agreements that people have signed, ensure the return of property, ensure that arrangements have been made to get a property back that maybe it's someone's home office or home in their trunk. You want to make sure you disable access to computer networks and to email for people that leave. And you, of course, want to obtain the appropriate usernames and passwords for any accounts that might themselves be in charge of or responsible for so that you have that access. You also want to make sure that you find out why is someone leaving when they leave the organization, to understand whether or not they're going to another, to a competitor. You want to make sure you check an employee's computer activities after they leave, and you want to make sure that, in fact, your information is secured and that this person doesn't pose a threat. You also want to, again, inform an employee of their continuing obligations. Consider sending a reminder letter to the employee when they leave, as well as potentially to the new employer. You want to potentially make sure that you preserve, and I think this is a very useful, inexpensive thing, is to preserve the hard drive from a computer that person uses. Take it, store it, either image it to a server, or just simply store it in the IT department in a cabinet in a sealed package. So if an issue arises, you can come back to it and look at it to see if someone took something, if you need to forensically examine it. You also want to make sure that you track your employees and something inappropriate later. You'd be surprised what you can find on LinkedIn, Facebook, and all these things as to what employees are doing after they leave. Finally, if you have any questions, you can certainly email us regarding questions from this presentation, but you can stay current on trade secret issues, social media issues, non-competes by going to our blog, tradesecretslaw.com. You also can sign up to get an RSS feed where anything loaded to the site comes to you automatically. You can also sign up for an email that comes to you when new information is posted so you can go look at the site. You can also request from the site our 2014 blog annual review, which has all of our blogs both in a hard copy booklet or in a CD. You can also request through our website, as was mentioned earlier, a copy of our social media desktop reference that has legislation and rules and a lot of information on a state-by-state basis, as well as we have a non-compete 50-state desktop reference as well that gives you the basics and 13 different topical areas for all 15 states. And again, you can request that through our website. Finally, I'm just looking at the questions here that a couple of folks have sent in. And let's see. One question is, does the Atlantic Marine case, that's Atlantic, like the ocean marine case, does it essentially eliminate the public policy exception that most states have used to not enforce such agreements? It doesn't eliminate it, but it certainly minimizes the effect of public policy on that. And by the way, there are cases that specifically say simply because a non-compete may be improper under certain circumstances, that does not mean that doing the conflict of law analysis, that it necessarily violates that public policy prong of that analysis. So, the Atlantic Marine case has some sweeping effects. You should read that case. I highly recommend it. And there have been a couple decisions since Atlantic Marine, one in, I believe, Ohio, another one in Louisiana, that have essentially said just because the law is different doesn't mean that we're not going to uphold the choice of law and venue provisions. And, in fact, they have been upheld. We have another question here. Let's see. Do we have a blog post with regard to how to develop a trade secret policy? I don't, and Robert could potentially chime in here, but I don't recall a specific blog post about how to develop your own trade secret policy. Certainly there are many blog posts that have probably every aspect of what you might want to have in it, but I don't think we have one sort of catch-all blog in which we said, here's everything that should be in a trade secret policy. And you can certainly email us and we could potentially give you some pointers and places to look if you want to for the person that submitted that question. I think that's all the questions. I think we've incorporated a number of the questions into the presentation. If you have any further questions, please feel free to email us. Our emails are there on that last screen, as well as phone numbers, and you can certainly go to the blog, tradesecretslaw.com, and find us there, or at sifarth.com and find us there as well. We'd be happy to answer any questions you may have. I think at this point, that's all the time we have that we have to present things. If you have any further questions, again, please contact us. We're happy to answer those questions, and if you want any of the materials that we've mentioned here, please feel free to contact us, and we can get you some of the materials that we have for informational purposes. Thank you for attending, and don't forget to submit your CLE and get credit for this hour that you spent with us. Thank you again.
Great. Thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.